Matt Puvala Show on Radio 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up even later with us. Good morning, Laura Vaughn. Thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Are you going to, do I need to send up some caffeine or anything? Are you used to these crazy hours?
No, but I think I brought lots of caffeine, so I'll be good.
That's good. That's good. You'll need it. I'll come up and like scare you at 4 a.m.
Ooh, perfect.
Just like give you a blah. Oh, I see. Now, my old producer, Kevin Richter, is here in studio with us. Kevin Richter and Michael Heidemann, who are the co-hosts of Sound Sessions here on WGNplus.com. And Kevin is also the famous producer of The Bill and Wendy Show, who got his start. How did you get your start again, Kev? Where did you, your claim
to,
you know, working your way up the ladder? Do we remember how we got there?
What I remember is both these individuals in this room scaring the crap out of me one day and
that's
being
right,
caught
Michael
on
was
video.
The guy.
Yes,
I forgot that.
Michael was the clown.
That is how I got my start here at the station, in fact.
That's right. You were interning for Pete McMurray at the time, right?
That's right. Yeah.
And Michael was really good. I was just, dude, if you ever want to do anything crazy like that again, I'm up for it.
Oh, I'm sure.
Do I still owe you money from that? I do, don't I?
No, you don't. Okay. Not at all. But I am waiting for the next crazy thing because I'm totally in. So maybe after the show, we could talk about how we're going to get Kevin.
I feel like I shouldn't talk too much about it because Shantae's right in the other room, and it should be a producer tradition.
Rite of passage.
That some producer tormented here. So this was 2 years ago now, Kev?
No, longer than that. Because
really?
I've been almost 2 years with Bill and Wendy now.
God, so like 2.5, 3 years ago, we were doing the show, and for some reason, I guess we did an interview with somebody that toured Haunted Chicago or something like that?
Yeah, we got on the topic of ghosts somehow.
There was a girl that called in about her high school.
Yes,
that was
that's
haunted,
what it was, yeah.
And you were like, I'd love to go there or something. So we talked about, well, we should do ghost hunting here in the Tribune Tower. Because
right.
I think maybe Amy Guth had at the time recently talked about a possible haunting thing on the 7th floor or the 4th floor or something like that. So we said, all right, let's do it live on the show and Kev will go up and do it. And I allegedly did some research into the building, and I talked to an archivist who had given me this whole story.
This backstory you came up with like, I mean, I have to give you credit. It was just so detailed and so incredible.
Phenomenal work.
So I wrote this story that I pretended that I had gotten out of the microfiche of the Tribune about this clown when WGN TV used to be in the building, this clown who had a kid's show who committed suicide in the building in a bathroom that's now on the 7th floor where WGN Radio is. And how women talk about they feel a chill in the air in the bathroom and this and that. So we're going to send Kevin up there at 2 in the morning live on the radio with cameras. And Michael Heider was hiding dressed up as a clown.
Michael, I don't know if I ever asked you, how long were you in the women's bathroom?
You know, I'm dedicated to my craft. So I was there for
since 4 in the afternoon.
Yeah, at least a solid hour, I'd say.
Wendy punched him once.
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, he got chased and arrested. But then he got back there.
Worth it.
Was it about an hour you were in there?
It was the squats that really hurt because I was like trying to make sure that my feet weren't showing because I really wanted to make it good.
I mean, full disclosure, I was too afraid to even go around the corner and check.
It's great because it's the weirdest bathroom that we have up on the 7th floor for women. You walk in, it's a straight line. There's like 3 stalls and 3 sinks. But then when you get to the end, there's a tiny little walkway, not even a normal size walkway, like a really thin walkway that goes around the corner. And then there's like 3 more stalls, totally hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And we had talked to Kevin about how if people stare into the mirror for long enough, this ghost appears.
It sounds ridiculous.
It does sound ridiculous. But the story was very, it's great watching the video, which you can still find at WGNradio.com, of Kevin, listening to me tell the story. We had to shorten it up for the video because it was, a really long story. But you're like, oh, wow, that's great. That's terrible. And then suddenly Kevin goes up and he's in the mirror and we have him on the phone live on the radio. And he's waiting, and nothing's happening. And I didn't give Michael a clear enough signal of, here's when you should come out. So you're trying. Mm-hmm. You can only hear Kevin making a noise once in a while, and you're trying to debate, okay, when do I go, when do I not go? And I think Michael's about to go, and my phone starts cutting out.
Yeah, that's what freaked me out.
Actually, really did freak you out.
You said, if you're staring in the mirror for 2.5 minutes or something like that, and at, 2 minutes, my phone starts breaking up, and that's when I'm like, all right, I'm out of here. No way.
And that's when Michael comes running out. And so Kevin moves the camera, unfortunately, but you hear Michael do, rawr or something. Kevin goes, rawr!
Yeah, the infamous scream. I still get a hard time for that.
That was a good
story. That was my first month here too. So that's how I got introduced to oh, this seems a fun place to work.
Yeah. A lot of fun.
Oh, good times. So Kevin soon after quit my show and moved on to Dean and then to Bill and Wendy. But we miss you terribly. It's great to have you here. And Michael, it's good to see you again as well. And you guys host Sound Sessions on WGNplus.com.
Yeah.
Tell me what Sound Sessions is all about.
Sound Sessions, it's our kind of all things music podcast. We're tackling festivals. We're tackling artist interviews. We're doing giveaways, gear talk, yada, yada, yada. I mean, Exactly. Anything music, we're just all about it.
A lot of intimate conversations. And, you know, it's not like the typical conversation you'll have with a musician where it's just like a few minutes with them. We sit down and you have like good like 20, 30-minute conversations with some of your favorite artists.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty solid.
Yeah. And a lot of I've seen a lot of your posts on Facebook. A lot of musicians come through Chicago that you guys bring in studio. It's not just you grabbing a phone over somebody.
No.
You're talking to – and a lot of local musicians too.
Yeah, we try to get into the local music scene as well. You know, we're lucky enough to – Chicago's a very active music city, so we're able to get them in the studio sometimes and get some intimate acoustic performances, which, you know, I have to like really contain my inner fanboy at times because it's just like I'm like screaming on the inside of these performances we're getting.
And Kevin, you're also in a band.
Yeah.
What's your band now?
Fade.
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 It's and two A's.
Two A's. Don't ask why, because I don't know why.
That sounded so funny. With two A's. With an umlaut.
Yeah.
So Fade, and it's you're always in, what do we call it? Not
instrumental.
Instrumental.
Yeah,
Thank you.
This group in particular is instrumental as well.
Instrumental.
It's just kind of my thing at this point.
Yeah.
So
Is there a whole instrumental scene? I think that's surprising to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, in Chicago, it's a very well-represented scene.
Really?
Some of the bigger acts in the instrumental scene are from Chicago, like a Russian Circles or a Pelican.
See, it's funny. I would think of instrumental as just sort of like that's going to be a jazz club. That's a jazzy thing.
Sure.
But that's not what you're playing.
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's more of a niche market, but it's, it runs the gamut of as far as genres go.
Now, so when you're in a club and you're playing instrumental music, are people talking more? Because it seems like to me, oh, this would be a good place to go with some friends because then we can still sort of chat as we're drinking and stuff and enjoying the music.
It depends. I mean, we're still loud, so so there's that. But, I mean, like, you know, when we
come... I thought there'd be less noise because they're not singing! This is loud!
Yeah, and you get that as well, too. Like, why don't you guys have any vocals? It's just, it's a conscious effort, you know.
Sing a lyric!
Well, it's conscious because I'm not a good singer. I don't know if anyone else in the band is, but, yeah, you know, we have fun.
How many pieces is the band?
Four of us.
Four of you.
Yeah.
And that one person can just grab a microphone and start.
It's not really like we're not. There's no desire.
Are there
for
microphones
it.
For you to talk on stage so you can talk between songs at all to the crowd?
Yeah, but we've only played one official show in this band so far, and we didn't use any mics actually for vocals. We actually, this is a little secret, little insider secret. Mm-hmm. Wendy Snyder voiced our introduction for us, and we kind of affected it and twisted it around, and it made it sound real.
You had a pre-taped introduction.
Yeah. So it said, you know, we are Fade, yada, yada, yada. Thanks for coming out.
And, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
And is Fade playing anywhere else sometime soon?
I believe August 6th at Elbow Room, and more to be determined.
And is there a website for Fade?
Not really at the moment. No, we're on Facebook. We're on Facebook.
Okay.
We're pretty low-key. I'm viewing it, you know, some guys like to work on a car in the garage. This is my car in the garage.
So you're getting to it when you can a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's like I'm working with two teachers, another guy, he's like a manager at a retail store. So we're all super busy. It's just a nice little release every week.
You gotta have that. That's good. And, you know, we used to talk a lot on the air when you were on the show. This is years ago about your girlfriend who is now your fiance.
Yep.
And there's a wedding coming up.
Yes, sir.
When is the wedding coming up?
September 23rd.
September 25th. I haven't gotten to save the date. And it's funny because Colleen and I, at the age we're at now, we never get to go to weddings. Because all our friends are old.
Well, listen,
and then
this
kids.
Is the time of the year.
And, you know, Mike, Steven, and Jenny Eck here. They met here. And I was good friends with both of them. No invitation to their wedding either. And so I'm wondering if I'm going to have another September go by without a wedding to go to. Seems that's where we're headed.
Listen, we have
Michael,
a lot.
I bet you're invited.
It's a small wedding.
Michael, are you going to? Oh, you're not invited either yet.
I'm still waiting for my saves the date. I need a magnet to put on my refrigerator for this.
What a dick.
Come on.
Honestly.
Come on.
Honestly. You know what? I don't have a girlfriend or anything, but once I do, Kevin, you're invited. And so are you, Matt.
Do you remember like when you were looking to get Bill and Wendy's show and I'm helping you and I'm like talking to you about how to approach things and like helping you out and giving you advice and all that stuff? Yeah. I remember those times. But that's not.
Listen. All right.
That's
guilt trip.
Yeah.
I'm not ruling things out yet, but we got to get through the family first. Well, you're like a B-lister maybe.
Wow. Whoa.
I'm going to stop talking about it.
Let me just say that's not how you tell somebody they're not invited. You're a B-lister.
It's a small wedding.
Well, it's really small and we've got so much family. I really want
that's
you there.
Exactly
I just
it.
Don't have, but you didn't say that. You said you're a B-lister.
Maybe.
It sounded like
I said maybe.
God. Michael, we'll go out drinking that day.
Exactly. And I think B stands for best.
You know,
so don't worry.
Let's start hitting on Sarah. Just to drive him insane.
You owe her a cat thing anyway, so.
That's fine. She was on the show, talked about how you two met. It's quite a story.
Yeah, and you know what? I've been trying to dig that. Well, this is like a secret. I want to play that audio day of, but I don't know how to find that audio anymore.
You know, if I was coming to the wedding, I'd help you with that, but since I'm not.
That was a lewd gesture.
That was a lewd gesture. I'll do it again. I don't care. It's ridiculous. Why do people not invite people to weddings anymore? I want to go to a wedding. Somebody in the listening audience, if you're getting married in the next year, Colleen and I would be happy to come to your wedding. We'd like to dance a little. We'll toast you. We'll buy a really awesome gift.
I would love
that's the thing is like, we would get you an awesome gift.
The gift alone.
Well, money would be great. If
you are the worst groom in the world. You're a B-lister. Oh, money would be great. Maybe I could work something out though.
Hey, it's a small wedding. God, they're expensive.
How small is it?
150.
150 people. That's a lot of people.
That's not a lot of people.
How is that not a lot?
It's a struggle. You would be surprised because it becomes more than just family. It's, you got to have this family friend, yada, yada. I don't want to be meeting people.
Who from WGN is invited?
I don't want to talk about it.
Who from WGN is invited?
I don't want to talk about it.
Bill and Wendy?
That's it.
That's it?
That's it.
That's all.
That's all.
That's the only people at all.
Yes. I swear to you.
See, when I was a full-time producer at WGN, I had like 8 people from the station at my
wedding. I wish I could. How many people was your wedding?
200.
See,
that's not that many more.
But it's still it's 50 more. It's 50.
But I had 8 people from GN at least.
I wish
June was there, the program director. You're not inviting Todd or Jimmy.
I can't.
You can't. Oh, can't means won't.
This is a trap interview, by the way. This is a ambush interview.
We brought you here today. For this reason only.
I mean, come on, Kev.
I would love for you to be there.
No, you wouldn't.
No, I truly would.
If you would love for me to be there, I'd be there.
I just can't at the moment.
I just can't. What does that mean? It means Sarah says, no, I can't invite the people I want to invite? Is that what it is?
No.
What's going on here? You invite the people you want to invite. You worry about the rest later.
Do you know how many friends I'm inviting to my wedding?
How many friends are you inviting
like
to your wedding?
8. That's all I can fit in. I'm not even kidding you. It's ridiculous. That's all I can fit in at the moment.
All right, so out of the 150,
family,
8
family
are friends.
Yes.
And then 142
friends
are family.
Friends and plus, it's crazy. I know, it's crazy. It's been a
struggle. Do you have that big of a family?
I do, and so does she. And then there's family friends and yada, yada, yada. And then they're Turkish, so the Turkish family friends, and it's just, it goes on and on and on, and my family's
Michael
huge.
Michael and I don't fit into family friends?
No.
You wouldn't have your career without the two of us. You'd have nothing. You were about to move to L.A. You'd be in L.A.
I wish.
You would be in L.A.
I still wish I was in L.A. I wasn't about to
move
to L.A.
Wow, and Bill and Wendy are coming to this wedding?
Yes.
Not after we play this for them, so there's 2 openings. Michael and I will be there, because they're going to be annoying.
All right, fine.
Our producer, who's been with us for a couple of years, wishes he was in L.A.
I would love to be on the West Coast one day.
No, you said right now. You can change it to one day, but the tape will play right now.
Right now.
So you wish you weren't with
Summer in Chicago.
You wish you were not with Trumps.
Summer in Chicago Trumps.
This isn't what we brought him in here for.
No, I apologize
to all listeners. Okay, we have to take a break. We're going to do the news. And then the reason you guys are actually here, as fun as this is because there was an interesting lawsuit. Led Zeppelin was sued over the song Stairway to Heaven, over the opening chords of Stairway to Heaven, basically, I believe, if I have this right, by the caretaker of an estate for a band called Spirit over their song Taurus. We'll play both for you after the news. I think it's fascinating because there are similarities, but there are differences. And I think other songs, you know, the George Harrison song, was it My Sweet...
Yeah,
Sweet
with
Lord.
I'm sorry, the name is escaping me. It's like a Motown song.
Totally. That is exact. It's just different lyrics laid over the song, in my mind.
Yeah.
The Tom Petty song that
Smith.
Won, I don't really hear it in that much.
I hear it. It's such a
little piece. Right. So we'll talk about that after the news and play some of that. And I wanted to bring you guys in to talk about it. As guys who make music and listen to music and care about music, I wonder how hard it is to not imitate something in some way. I mean,
it's pretty hard.
We've had music for 100-some years now in the recorded form. It's got to be hard not to have been influenced in some weird way by something. So how similar is something when it's copied and when it's just, it's inspired by or in the form of? We'll talk about that after the news next on 720 WGN. So there's the beginning of Stairway to Heaven that we've all known for millions of years. It's very famous to us all. You two are too young for this, and Chante's clearly too young for this too. But when I hear the beginning of Stairway to Heaven, I actually think of an old, I think it was WXRT commercial from like the 70s, maybe the 80s. And I think it's John Cleese. I think. Maybe it's not. I think he had done some stuff for them. So they're talking about how, I think it was talking about how XRT doesn't play the same song over and over again. And so you hear the beginning chords of this, and then he's holding up a pizza and he's like, to think this was once Stairway to Heaven. Like, it had been played so many times, it looks like pizza. And they play the chords. So the beginning, it was a great commercial about how XRT plays different music than what everybody else is playing. I think it was XRT. I don't think that was the loop. I'm pretty sure it was XRT. But that's what I think of when I hear that song. So it's hard for it to remain a favorite of mine. So that's the famous intro to Stairway to Heaven, written by, and it's funny to me that Robert Plant was part of this trial, because while he wrote the lyrics, he clearly didn't write that part that they're talking about. Right. So I didn't understand why he was even part of this.
I guess the claim is that they had played shows together and yada, yada, yada. Yeah. They were familiar with their catalog.
When Led Zeppelin played their very first show here in the U.S., or was it their very first tour, Taurus was opening for them.
I think it was the other way around, even, I had heard.
Zeppelin was opening for
like
Taurus?
A long time ago. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I had heard,
I thought I heard it the other way around. We'll have to look into that. But either way, they were on the same bill together at some point. They could have run into each other's music. Certainly led to, and is this a famous, this song Taurus, is this famous at all? Would they have heard it on the radio? Would it have been in the public consciousness, or only if they really knew Taurus's work?
It's an instrumental track. I don't believe Spirit or Spirit is an instrumental band. They claim to be familiar with other songs in their catalog, but seem to have Jimmy Page claims that he heard Taurus for the first time 2 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
So. And that was one of the contentions in the trial, was he's like, well, my son-in-law, I think he said, played this for me because I don't do the internet at all, and so he played it for me. I'd never even heard them. And then they're like, well, they were on the same bill as you guys. You played with them before. And he said, really? I thought that was some other band. Which clearly you can imagine Page back in those days having no clue who was on any play. He's like, dude, I'm lucky I'm even here. Remember that.
Exactly. And it's funny because, you know, he did actually have the album, which when they cross-examined him, but he has 4,000 other albums that he was listening to. And he actually said, you know, he was quoted saying that, you know, don't remember them now. Don't remember them then. Don't remember them ever. And so, I mean, it's one of those bands that, you know, could come in and out of consciousness.
It is interesting that he has their album, though. I mean, was he being pretty defiant on the stand? Was he like, sort of like, how dare you think that I stole this? I mean, that quote that you just gave, Michael, makes it sound like he was being pretty flippant about Spirit and their place in history, and how could you think I stole this from them?
Exactly. And think about the fact that it is one of the best known songs of all time. It made them countless amounts of money. I mean, there was the Condé Nast portfolio, which is what kind of gives a description of how much a song makes, estimated it at more than $562 million in publishing rights.
That song, not the Led Zeppelin catalog, song.
In royalties and record sales since it released.
And the interesting thing is, this lawsuit was not about going back to, and when did the song come out? 71, 72, somewhere in there, right?
Yeah, I'd say that.
Very early 70s. The lawsuit was only going to cover royalties for like the last 5 years or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't understand, if you say they copyright it, how does it not go back in perpetuity?
I'm not sure if that falls into like some sort of like statute of limitations type thing. I don't know the exact legalities of it all, but yeah.
I mean, I guess you can't say somebody owe me something forever. Maybe it's part of that. All right. So, Shantae, the band was Spirit. The song is called Taurus. Mm-hmm. This is the piece that they claim Stairway ripped off. Far into the song it is, the exact portion.
I think it's coming up.
I'm grooving on this Yaz flute that we're hearing.
So far, it doesn't sound really similar. So far.
I agree. Very dramatic.
Go ahead and I'm going to pat you down, Shantae. Go ahead and rewind it to where that guitar just kicked in and save it there. And if you would re-cue up also Stairway to Heaven, so we can play just the pieces sort of side by side. Now, yesterday when I was showing you on Facebook, our old PD Mary June Rose had posted this guitar guy who played just the guitar of both of them.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what? To me, that doesn't sound that similar. Yeah. Now that I hear it there, it sounds a lot more similar to me than I thought it was going to.
Right.
There's definitely differences within the songs. There's a lot more layers to the Zeppelin song, and mm-hmm. I know there's changes in there, but there's this descending bass line was the term we heard.
Yeah, right? It's a very, I mean, if it's not exact, it's a very similar chord progression. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. What would your take have been if you had heard, let's real quick, let's go ahead and play these. Shantae, could you go ahead and do Stairway to Heaven? Okay, I'm going to fade you down. Go ahead and cue back up Taurus by Spirit. And when you're ready, go ahead and hit that. So they don't do the dun-dun-dun
right.
at the end of it.
Right.
But there's like 5 or 7 seconds. It's very similar. Yeah. It's not exact, though, correct?
No, I mean, Jimmy Page is throwing in some embellishing notes as he does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's not an exact... I mean, even the picking pattern is a little different, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so when you guys hear that, what is your first thought?
To be honest, if I was in my car and I was listening to a radio station playing that, I'd be like, oh, this is Stairway to Heaven. If it was, and then I'd be like, oh, shoot, no, this is Taurus, that other great band.
See, I don't know that I would go that far, personally. I would say, okay, yeah, this sounds like Stairway yeah. a little bit, but it's definitely got its differences. Maybe it's just because I've heard the song so many times that
Man.
I know it like the back of my hand.
No yeah. Stairway, denied.
What? Is that a Wayne's World quote?
Yeah.
Is
that yes, yeah.
I had to bust it in.
All right. So, Kevin, as somebody who writes music,
yeah.
how difficult is it when you write a song to not go, oh, God, that actually sounds like something else, and you didn't even realize it?
So in the Western scale, which all music that we know basically is written in, such as these two songs that we're listening to, there's only 12 notes. That's A through G sharp. There's only 12 notes.
Okay.
So with that said, obviously there's going to be some overlap there. For example, I wrote a song and I wrote a bass part I was really excited about and I thought it was totally original. Come to find out after having written it and recorded it and played it live for people, somebody said, hey, one day somebody said to me, hey, that sounds like the Chain bass line by Fleetwood Mac, which was written I don't even know how many years ago.
Yeah.
And it's almost...
Before you were born.
Yeah, exactly. And it was almost note for note without me even ever hearing that song before.
Are you sure you had never heard it?
I had never heard it, I promise you. And sure enough. But my point being, it's very easy.
You had really never heard it?
I had really never heard it. Now I love
the
song.
Are you sure you didn't hear it and like maybe you just didn't realize you had heard it?
I mean, I'm about
99. I mean, because it seems
it's a very popular song,
that
right.
even if there's only 12 notes, there's still a million variations.
Sure,
right?
Certainly. And then when you build those 12 notes into a chord, yeah, there's all these other different variations and ways you can make it more complex and different from other chords. But point being, yeah, I think it's very easy to... I mean, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
In theory, everything has already been written in one way
in
or another.
In some way, shape, right. or form.
And right. there's also a formula in Western music. I believe it's called the 1-4-5, where it's just a chord progression. Like, what's the song? 8-6-7-5-3-0-9-9.
Mm-hmm.
That's a prime example of the guitar riff. It's a 1-4-5, and it's used in... You can look up videos of it, 1-4-5 in music, and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of songs that use that.
Really?
It's just what sounds good in our scale.
So Led Zeppelin ended up winning the lawsuit.
Right.
I didn't read enough on the verdict. What was said about why they won the lawsuit?
I think it was they couldn't find enough evidence that Led Zeppelin had actually heard the song. And maybe Michael, I'm not sure if you have the exact text on it, but yeah, that he hadn't actually heard the song. They couldn't provide enough proof for it. Mm-hmm. So
it's not enough that it sounds similar. They want some proof that you did
right.
intend to do that.
Exactly.
Is that where the leeway is, that we know there's going to be similarities? We want to know. Like in the Tom Petty song, who was it that...
Sam Smith.
Sam Smith gets... Tom Petty now has a songwriting credit on that mm-hmm. song and has received money for it.
Yeah.
Tom Petty was really cool about it, saying these things happen. It's not a big deal.
Right.
But did they prove that there was – and
Marvin Gaye,
Alan Thicke, and those – Robin Thicke.
Yeah.
Not Alan Thicke. That would have been
See, that one – that's a point I was going to bring up is there are so many more, way more egregious examples of just blatant plagiarism. You know, in that Robin Thicke one, that's spot on.
And that's – you know what? And that to me seemed more like sampling.
Right.
Because sampling is a big thing, especially in a lot of rap songs, where they're taking pieces of songs
yeah.
and using it. So I don't know where it's plagiarism, where it's, well, we sampled that song. And then when you sample, you do have to pay for it. You right. have to give a credit. They didn't in this instance. But they fought back on that vigorously. They didn't say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Right, I mean, in all of these, they're fighting back on
it. Yeah, but they end up losing.
Yeah.
It's just – it's a really slippery slope. I mean, it's going to happen, but – I mean, there's another prime example, too. I'm not sure if a lot of people are even aware of this one. Viva La Vida by Coldplay.
Okay. Yeah.
They got sued by Joe Satriani. And if you look it up on YouTube or whatever, it's note for note.
Really?
Note for note.
And so they lost that one and they lost that one. Paid up for that one. Yep. That's interesting. All right. So you guys were mentioning off the air that this part that I hadn't seen about it, seen a little headline. So 400 years ago.
Yeah.
And what's the name of the composer?
It was an Italian composer by the name of Giovanni Battista Granata.
So we have no recordings of this. Right. As it was written at the
time.
You
have the sheet music.
But you have the sheet music. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was it written for the piano at the time, then?
Well, judging by the name, it's Sonata di Chitarra e Violino con il suo bus. I'm not even going to try anymore. But it sounds like there was violin. And they had guitars and lutes back then and things like that. So I think it was intended for those.
Okay, so here's a piece of that, which if you're going to say something sounds like Stairway to Heaven, listen to this. I mean, that part, let's go back here. Let me try that again. It's coming up here in just a few seconds. Beautiful little Spanish-sounding song. And then it kicks right into almost note for note right about here. Other than the dun-dun-dun
right.
at the end.
It gets a little different there, but
that's really...
That's Stairway.
But now that wasn't introduced into this court case at all, right?
I don't think this particular one was, but there was another one, a song that was like a Irish folky song that was written in the 60s that was introduced, but it wasn't as blatant as this one.
Yeah.
Do you think that if they would have put that song out as like an electric guitar instead of the acoustic guitar, there would be so many intense examples? Because I feel like the production level has a lot to do with the fact that everyone's saying that the song kind of sounds alike, to be honest. I mean, the way that they kind of crafted that song, to be honest, that Gustav's great hit that I love so much, it didn't sound as strong as an example as the Taurus song, to be
Wait,
honest.
Wait, what
really?
We just played?
You think
what
so?
We just played?
To be honest,
See,
I feel
that
like,
was
wow.
the song.
That was it, in my mind.
Oh, my
But I do get what he's saying because Taurus builds up with the synthesizers and all that.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
In Stairway, it's not in the intro itself. There's no synthesizer, but later in the track, you know, it builds in the synths and the strings and yada yada yada. So I can kind of see where you're coming from, but I'm with you on this one.
This sounds what we just played from the 17th century sounds like you could start singing at the end of that
right,
song.
Right.
And you know, Robert Plant always said that he was a huge fan of that guy's work too. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. He's got a tattoo of him actually.
I don't know when you two are lying sometimes. A texter points out something very interesting. That's true. 773 writes, the jury didn't even get to hear Spirit's version. They only got to see the music sheet. And that is true. They didn't allow them in the – they played Stairway to Heaven fully through. They never played the song for the jury because the lawsuit was about – I forget what it was. It was something about – it wasn't about the recorded version wasn't copyrighted right, but the sheet music was. So they – could only present to the jury
That's
and talk them through that. And you could see where that would be very difficult to hear it in your head unless you're a true musician. Like,
right.
I would have never been able to make sense of it.
Certainly.
Unless I got to hear it.
Right. And there's a lot of things that come into factor there, too. By just looking at sheet music, you're not seeing necessarily what the tempo is and things like that.
And I don't know. I can't imagine the jury was sequestered, but I would have gone home at night and for sure looked up the song and listened to it. So I don't know that they all didn't listen to it at some point. It'd be hard not to, but... But man, that other song to me, Michael. Oh my gosh, that's the exact song.
It's spot on.
But it's interesting because so we're talking about 8 seconds of a 7 minute song, and the song is extremely different. As Michael said, these great hits that all have these different levels and change completely what type of song they are. So what is plagiarism in that term? Is it this? Because it's not like it's a repeating thing throughout the song, like Vanilla Ice with Ice Ice Baby.
Right.
He steals that from Queen.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then it gets sued and they have to pay for it. This is like a few seconds of a song. So what point is it like, oh, yeah, that sounds like it, but that's not that song.
I think we still don't have an answer for that even when it comes to hip hop and, you know, samples and music. They say you can use up to like 10 seconds. But then if you're repurposing it in a certain way, I mean, the rules and the laws on it are very unclear, honestly. Yeah. So certain individuals are taking advantage, and, you know, it's tricky.
Mark's been kind enough to hang on the phone for quite a while here. Mark, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning.
Yeah, I have a bunch of points to run by you real quickly, okay. And I'm gonna save the musical selections for last in case your producer needs to cue them up or whether she found them or not. But and I want to say I hope Laura Vaughn gets a permanent gig. She is sounding great.
Oh, I'll pass that along.
This is Mark Lindsay. Hi, Laura. Any composition professor on the college level will tell you that it is virtually impossible not to duplicate previous musical patterns in some way. And composition majors are told this. Jimmy Webb, my second point, Jimmy Webb wrote a book about songwriting. He wrote songs that people like The Fifth Dimension and Glenn Campbell did, and he said that in today's music industry, songwriters have to be really careful that they don't plagiarize, because they might do it even if their unconscious has never heard a song before. And then my third thing is that, the two selections you played are both in the key of A minor, which is real interesting. There are two others that I want to point out that are not only in the key of A minor, but sound incredibly alike. One of them is Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You by Led Zeppelin, and the other is 25 or 6 to 4 by Chicago. If you play those side by side, you would wonder why Led Zeppelin didn't sue Chicago the moment that song came out.
Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You.
I can hear 25 or 6
to 4. Yes, Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, because 25 or 6 to 4 goes da 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 da, and the Led Zeppelin song slower goes da 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 da.
But what other songs have you heard that in so many times over and over? That same melody.
Green Day does a song that's very similar to that, too.
Hitchin' a Ride.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much for the call, Mark. So it is very difficult for musicians these days, too. And it's funny, Kevin, that you were actually already playing it live. And then somebody said something. What if that would have been a hit? What if that would have broken through and you're on the radio?
Right. I'm
Fleetwood
sure
Mac, hammer down on you.
And what he said about A minor, that's an interesting point, too. In my opinion, writing in A minor and E minor or E in A major are very easy keys to write in, because you have the availability of open strings by strumming an open E, and then you can kind of, you know, riff on the neck even more so.
All right, Shantae has one of those songs. Go ahead, Shantae. This is Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You by Led Zeppelin. All right, let's fade that down. Do you have 25 or 6 to 4 also available? All right, Shantae's going to bring that up now. I don't hear it in my head at all. I know that sound. I'm sorry, that's not even close.
I hear it.
Are you serious?
It's different, but I hear what he's saying. But you can't make that argument, though. In my opinion, there's no way that would ever, ever stand up.
I'm just going to go just by the smell test, and that's not even close. That's not even close. Come on. Somebody texted that Led Zeppelin's notorious for their musical thievery.
It's true.
Old blues songs, right? But they remade some blues songs. Yeah. I mean, did they truly steal and make their own songs from it, or did they, you know, do covers of old blues songs?
I don't know. I guess technically it would be a cover, but I'm not sure.
But at least one of the songs off their first album I know is not a Led Zeppelin writing credit, I think. I think it's a Robert Johnson song, right?
That's what I was going to ask, because I'm not sure if they were giving the correct credits, and that's where they would get in trouble.
Not 100% sure of that. Well, this has been fascinating. Guys, thank you so much for coming in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Sound Sessions, new podcast just about every week at WGNplus.com. Michael, who are you? Where else do we find you around here these days?
So you can find me on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand.
I'm doing that
on a daily basis. Yes.
Isn't he the worst?
Bertrand? Oh, my God. Don't get me started.
He is.
But he will be at Kevin's wedding this summer, I'm sure.
Yes, he will. He's going to be giving him away. And couldn't be happier for that. So stay tuned for that. And you can find me, at Sound Sessions. We're pretty much everywhere. You can find us on Sound Sessions Pod on Twitter, Sound Sessions on Facebook. And, check us out for a lot of great Chicago-based interviews. It's fantastic.
And find them at WGNplus.com and Kevin's Bad Fade with two A's.
Bad? You said bad.
Kevin's
Freudian
band,
slip.
Bad band. Kevin's band, Fade, with two A's, is playing next at the Elbow Room.
Yeah, August 6th, Elbow Room.
August 6th. And find you guys on Facebook as well. Search for Fade with two A's.
Two A's.
On Facebook. Guys, thanks so much for coming.
Matt, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely, guys. Anytime. The Matt Bubala Show, Radio 720 WGN. I got to chat about this earlier today with my friends at DNAinfo.com, where I'm the broadcast editor as well, and I do little audio stories throughout the week, and we've been following the stories about the Lucas Museum of Narrative Art. I will, Elliot, go ahead and call it by the right name for you.
Thank you.
Elliot Serrano has been kind enough to stick around for the Patty Vasquez Show and hang out to talk a little bit about this with me, because this is near and dear to my heart, because I'm a huge Star Wars geek. I was 5 years old when the first movie came out. So it's really been throughout my life, a part of my life. The movies have come and gone, but Star Wars has always been a part of my life. And I love that it has come back and I've been able to share it with my own kids. And my daughter just absolutely loved the latest movie. And I love that it had a strong female character and got her that excited. And she actually went back with me to see it a second time, which I never would have predicted. So it was awesome. And I love the idea of this museum. I don't know what the heck it is, and that's part of the problem, I think, that Mr. Lucas has created for himself. The Lucas Museum of Narrative Art would have sort of been, people maybe not so in love with it, would say a warehouse for all of his stuff. They would say it's a place to honor the art of storytelling in all of its forms, including the digital forms. Of course, it would have had a lot of Star Wars stuff, but he has a ton of artwork he's collected over the years. And supposedly it would have done a lot to help foster the knowledge of the narrative arts and writing and storytelling and things like that. But the plan is George Lucas originally wanted his museum to be in San Francisco. I believe the land where the Presidio is, right?
Well, that's where currently Lucasfilm, they're at the Presidio now.
Okay.
He wanted the art, the Museum of Narrative Art to be on the Bayfront.
Okay.
So that's where that was his ideal in San Francisco, his hometown as a child, as a teenager, and then have it there.
And that was land that they wouldn't give up, the land he originally wanted.
A lot of the same issues that he ran into here in Chicago, he also ran into
there.
In San Francisco.
And so when that didn't work out in San Francisco, his new wife, relatively new wife for the last few years, Melody Hobson, is from Chicago, and they live here at least part of the year. So they said, what about Chicago? And Rahm Emanuel was on board. We have this museum campus down there. It does make sense to me to add another museum to a museum campus, especially when the Field Museum has had its struggles in the last few years and has talked about their budget struggles. And if you put something down there that is going to bring additional hundreds of thousands of people, that's going to benefit the other museums and benefit the city, certainly. Friends of the Park, who is a ardent defender of our green space along the lakefront, filed a lawsuit to stop it from happening. Now, the museum was originally supposed to be built just south of Soldier Field and a little bit north, so in between McCormick Place East and Soldier Field. Right now, there's some green space. There is an open-air parking lot, which is kind of an eyesore. This originally would have replaced that parking lot, correct?
Correct.
Friends of the Park sued to stop that. Then Rahm's office said, how about we tear down McCormick Place and we put it there? And Friends of the Park didn't relent on that. Now, that second part of it would have cost us $1.2 billion.
Yeah, the city would have had to take a bond issue for that, which currently, with the city's credit rating being what it is, wouldn't have been the best thing.
No, it wouldn't have. It wouldn't have. They were going to lease the land to George Lucas for the next 99 years for $1 a year. At which point, I don't know what happens exactly. I imagine that's a renewable lease as long as the museum is being operated in some way that's agreed upon. And it would have brought revenue to the city in some form. It would have brought jobs, things like that. So I think there's a lot of interesting ways to talk about this. Elliot, you are upset that Friends of the Park forced this issue enough to the point where George has said, that's it, I'm not going to do it here, right?
I was miffed because I think the folks at The Reader did a nice piece on that. It was kind of like Friends of the Park was their pursuit of the perfect was kind of getting in the way. This was the whole, I mean, first, I will say I do understand the perspective that Friends of the Park had, that if you have a private developer working on a land that we are promising to the public that should never be used for private purposes, mm-hmm. you're setting a precedent. But let's be honest, today in this current economic climate, things being what they are, I mean, show me a private developer or show me anywhere where you're going to find money to develop that property the way Friends of the Park says it should be. Lucas was willing to come in and essentially take a slab of asphalt, turn it into not only a world-class museum, but also additional green space that was lacking in that area. Yeah, a lot of folks are going to say, well, why does it have to be on the lakefront? Why can't it be on any of the other areas? Well, okay, so someone comes to you and says, I want to give you $750 million to build a museum. All I'm asking is that you put it in this place right here. I don't know if, and again, I'm just giving it to you.
Mm-hmm.
$750 million that later on is going to result in economic development for your city. It's going to result in new jobs. It's going to result in more tourism. Let's face it. So the city of Chicago is all about tourism right now. Mm-hmm. And it would have been a world-class museum, which, I mean, again, wouldn't have existed anywhere else in the world. To say that, okay, no, we want to have that area developed as just green space, you know, which, again, I'm a conservationist. I believe in green space as well. But, again, pursuing the perfect for Friends of the Park kind of ended up – to me, it was like almost like Don Quixote tilting at windmills. Because now Friends of the Park has to deal with the whole backlash of a lot of folks saying, well, you know what? We could have had this great thing. It was practically a gift to the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. But because we're saying it can't be here, it can't, you know, you can't do this there. And again, Friends of the Park, they're having a hard time dealing with the whole public relations aspect of it. Because then what did Rahm Emanuel say? You know what? Okay, fine. You don't want to have it there because we don't want to give up this green space. We're going to take up this area over here. And that's already developed anyway, but it's an eyesore, and no one's doing anything with it anyway. So let's turn that into something better. And Friends right. of the, you know, the again, the McCormick Place right. issue that you referred to. And Friends of the Park were saying, no, you can't do that either. So it's like, Seal, come on, we're trying to come up with a compromise here. And there was really no compromise. I respect what they were saying, and they will tell you it was not a case of saying, we don't want a museum there. Why can't you have the museum somewhere else? But the pursuit of perfect is kind of what, you know, it's kind of like when you dig your heels in for the perfect solution on your side of the issue. That's kind of what hurt everyone.
Well, so I would say that Friends of the Park wants no development. The promise or the doctrine, whatever we have, is that there's supposed to be no development, private development, east of Lakeshore Drive.
Unless
that
it's
supposed
Field
to
Museum.
Remain free and clear.
Unless it was Field Museum. Which was in violation of everything that Friends of the Park is supposed to be about.
But that was built before, I believe, all of this.
Well, yeah, that was a really part of it. That was a part
That's
of it.
That's well before.
Chicago Magazine wrote a great piece on that, talking about
Lakeshore Drive used to be on the other side of the
Correct.
Field
Museum. So there's a lot of stuff that can change. But go
right.
on, I'm sorry.
Right. So the idea is, though, in general, we have this land. We only have so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we should keep it free and clear and open to the public instead of putting things there. That's the idea that they're trying to preserve. That's why they kept the kids' museum out of Grant Park and things like that. They fight for the green space. And I respect it because we do only have so much of that. And it's funny you mentioned that in these economic times, I think that's why we need them more than ever in a way, because it's very easy for us to say, listen, we're dying here. We are so far in debt. We're not paying the pensions. We've already sold the Skyway and our parking meters. We need some infusion here. Well, we've got this primo space. We ought to do something with it. And so we need them to fight for it. Where I do think I worry for them that they overplayed it is by forcing this away and this not working out now. Do Rahm and legislators and people still go to court to fight for the right to develop this land in the future? In which case, we could end up with a casino instead of a museum, and Friends of the Park loses altogether. I think that is a worry for them to consider now that they push back so hard on this. But on the other hand, George Lucas, yes, it would have been a great gift to the city, possibly. We don't truly know what this museum would have been. We say it would be a world-class museum. You don't really know that until it opens and it gets judged, right? George Lucas didn't want to play ball except with Rom. He didn't like, you know, George, did you read Blair Kamen's article about this today?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a really good article, and a lot of the points that I'm saying are in here. George Lucas said, I want to do this there or else I'm not doing it. So he took his ball and went home, basically, here.
His BB-8 and went home.
And
BB-8's a ball, in case, for those of you.
Let's assume they know. Let's assume they saw the movie and they know who BB-8 is.
A really cute ball.
Yes. And it's funny because when I first saw that, I thought, oh, God, here comes the Jar Jar Binks of this next movie. And boy, was it not.
It was not, right.
But so I felt Friends of the Park. Although I'm okay with this museum not being here. I do wish it was here. I was very excited when it was announced. I think it was the perfect place for it. This museum campus is a perfect place for it. But on the other hand, I understand that, no, we should be fighting to get back green space. And if we're going to get rid of that parking lot, let's make it green space. If we're going to get rid of McCormick Place, let's make it green space. Although, God, if McCormick Place is already there and it's going to stay there now, it would have been better to have this museum there. But I think George Lucas was unwilling to come up with any alternative. I have the $1 billion. I want it there or else it doesn't get done is like a child with a tantrum to me. He wouldn't accept the idea of anything else. And there were other ideas. We're going to build hopefully an Obama library somewhere. And if they want to serve the South Side and those brown and black kids so much, as Melody Hobson said, why not put it there? Why not start developing a new tract of land for Chicago to really help people? But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to play that card a little bit, though. And that annoyed me to death that they started, oh, you're not going to help these kids. And Father Flager, I'm sorry, but give me a break, that this was going to help all these kids so much. That's such a load of BS. It would have been a few jobs, but that's not where they live on the museum campus. It's difficult to get to for people on public transportation, things like that. It's not like there would have been this boon of jobs for people on the South Side that this would have saved. And the telling of narrative arts and helping all these people learn this stuff, that means you got to get to that museum. If they really wanted to do that, they could find a way to have this in Chicago, not there, or play ball a little more and figure out how to get it there. Friends of the Park did finally come up with their list of demands. You know, Lucas is saying there are, you know, words like extortion were used. He says they wanted to save a parking lot. That's BS. Rom said they're off negotiating with themselves. They all could have played ball a little more. I'm not saying Friends of the Park aren't at fault, but they came up with here's where we're willing to drop the lawsuit. Did he go and try to negotiate that down to something more amenable to the city? I think he just said, you know what, forget it. We're going to pull up and move out. And I don't think George Lucas is fully committed to California yet, because they didn't say, and here's where it's going to go. They've just said, we're pulling out. That's it. So I don't think this deal is completely dead, because I think him and Rom are have become friends over this. And maybe Rom said to him, this is what you're going to have to do. We're going to have to try to pull this. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe we did lose it forever. I don't know. But I think that the city, you know, the demands maybe were outrageous. I don't think they were so outrageous that the city couldn't have tried to work with Friends of the Park to see what they could do with what their demands were. Redevelop a park. A certain amount of the fund should go towards parks. That's okay. Did you see anything in those list of five demands that you thought, oh, this is crazy that they're even demanding this?
Well, it seems to me, again, my only criticism of Friends of the Park, and again, personally, as a conservationist, and while I respect what they're saying, is like, okay, you have these ideas that this is what's going to happen, but okay, first, you can't get past this whole issue that it's a parking lot. It wasn't like the Lucas Museum was trying to take away existing green space and repurpose it.
Right.
So it was trying to develop, and they wanted to add green space in addition to the museum.
Yeah, it would have added some more green space. Yeah. It, quite honestly, from the renderings of the original, it would have looked better. I mean, we could argue about the actual museum itself, because wasn't the prettiest thing in the world.
Right.
But it was like avant-garde. You know, the bean was weird when it first came out. Now, we love that thing today.
And Soldier Field now. It's the Independence Day spaceship in the middle of...
Soldier Field's still very ugly from the outside, very good on the inside.
They took a classic monument, a classic artifact of history, and they ruined it. So
they landed a spaceship on it.
It looks like that
when you drive by.
Right. So again, speaking, you know, with all due respect to Friends of the Park, but again, you're talking about pursuing the perfect here. Now, with Lucas, I think with perspective to give me perspective to it, I can kind of sympathize with him because it seemed like he had all this political issue with the same kind of political stuff going on in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Having land, we're talking property that he owned. He owned this real estate in San Francisco and was being told he couldn't do what he wanted to do with it.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that part.
Yeah,
so he owns the land he wanted to build on in San Francisco this, and they said no?
They said no.
Why?
It was, again, zoning issues.
Has to be green space?
Yeah, all this. Well, not green space, but it's like it was the whole thing with again, the same thing. We don't know what you're going to do, so we don't trust you. Why are you doing that? Mm. And there was, again, he owns all this real estate in the San Francisco area, in the Marin County area, and he's being told you can't do this, that, and the other with it.
Yeah.
So he thought that by bringing it, and again, this is my interpretation of the events. He thought by coming to Chicago, and okay, we can fault him for dealing with solely with Rahm Emanuel, but let's be honest. If you want to
think that's how you're going to get it done,
you're get it done, right? So he's like, okay, Rahm Emanuel says this is what we're going to do. Bing, bang, and the other, and then you have the Friends of the Park who suddenly say, no, you can't do that because we have been charged with protecting the lakefront for this purpose. And again, respectfully speaking,
you can quit saying respectfully. We understand your respect. Friends of the Park. It's fine.
Okay,
they're fine.
Okay,
they could take it.
No, because they've been like getting trashed on their Facebook page.
Well, that's but you know what? That's what they're there for, and I bet they understand that and they know that's going to happen.
Yeah, but that's why they're deleting all the little the criticisms on their Facebook page because they can handle it, right?
All right, maybe they're a little hurt.
They're a little hurt right now, but again, it's you see that you're going okay. In this day and age, when money is so short to come by, if you really want to develop that into something, okay, you already have the Northerly Ireland development. It's not turned out to be what they wanted it to be, okay? You have, again, a parking lot. I would understand if you were talking about any other parcel of land where it was existing green space and you're afraid of losing it.
Yeah.
We were talking about asphalt. Friends of the Park is saying we need to just make this green space, period. Okay, where are you going to find the money to do that?
Yeah.
Who are you going to find that's going to do that for you? Tell me, where are you going to get the $750 million to develop that? Because let's face it, in this economy now, no one's stepping up to do that.
But I don't think Friends of the Park is worried about that. I think they said it's fine how it is. It's a parking lot right now, and that's fine. When it changes, it's going to become green space. And that's our goal, is that anything that changes becomes more green space. And I'm relatively okay with that because we are going to run out of it. I worry that, like I said, they're going to shoot themselves in the foot and now it's going to backfire and we're going to pursue harder getting to develop things because we don't know how this lawsuit would have turned out in the courts. If I think eventually down the line, Rahm would have won. Eventually, at some point, the city would have won.
Lot of money, though.
It would have cost money and it would have taken years maybe, and George isn't willing to wait around. But I'm telling you, I don't think this is over yet. I'll bet you a dollar. I bet you a dollar there's still a chance this thing ends up here. I think this is partly a ploy. Because he's got some landfill land where they want to put it in San Francisco. He doesn't want, he's not putting it out on Staten Island.
He wants it on the bayfront. He wants, it's always been the thing. He wants it was an ocean view before, but now it's a lake view. I mean, your point of view, I can see where you're coming from. This reminds me a lot of the debate that people had back when the White Sox were talking about moving the team to Sarasota unless the state would give them a brand new stadium.
Yeah.
And then they they tore down old Comiskey, build new Comiskey.
It was Tampa, I mean, where the Rays play. The stadium was built for the White Sox.
Correct. And then for the longest time, people were saying that the Cubs really wanted to get the city to approve renovations of Wrigley Field, they should have threatened to move to Arlington Heights or somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you're right. There's that political hardball that you're playing saying, okay, you know what? Maybe I am going to go. I'm going to go. It's that poker table bit.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to sit at the poker table. I'm going to say, no, you know what? Call me. If you think I'm bluffing, call me, da-da-da, and we'll see how it goes. I can see that gamesmanship there, but then there's that risk where there's a disingenuous bit about it where you're like, okay, if this really means so much to you, or if it's something that you felt, okay, people are saying, why isn't it going anywhere else? You know, there are all these other plots of land that it should go to, you know? Well, that's you showing all your cards. You know, that's you saying, okay, this is my hand, I fold, or, you know, this is what I've got.
Right.
You're not going to win the pot that way.
But George, I don't think it's just him not showing his hands. I don't think he is willing to accept anything else. I think he'd rather not build it than have to build it within the city. It sounds like. I mean, he wants, and it's his $1 billion, so it's his right to say, well, then I don't want to do it, so I'm going to do it somewhere else. So that's fine. That is his choice. I do think Rom goes to friends now and says, look at what you just did, and this is going to hurt you, and we're going to fight. We're going to fight.
Everybody's doing that now.
Well, but what's important is Rom, and if he goes to them and says, here's what's going to happen now, I'm going to continue this court case, and we're going to fight to do whatever we want, and I'm going to make sure that this happens, and then they've got to negotiate with it. And I don't see why they don't negotiate. I don't think the demands were that bad. They're saying, listen, if you're going to take up some green space, if we're not going to take whatever happens and make it more open green space, then you've got to build some more somewhere else or redevelop on the south side and west side. If they want to help these kids so much, then let's put some of the revenues from this going into redeveloping those parks. I think those are fair things to ask about or at least negotiate from. And I don't know how much the city did on their end, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for staying later, Elliot. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you online?
You can always find me on Twitter at Elliot Serrano, 2 L's, 2 T's and 2 R's. You can also find me on Instagram and on Facebook, facebook.com/Elliot.Serrano. Matt, it's always great to spend some time
with
you.
It's good hanging out with you. I always get to see Elliot at the end of the Patty Vasquez show every week, but then we never get to hang out together. So thank you for having the conversation with me. I appreciate it. The Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up late with us tonight here on WGN Radio. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on Michigan Avenue, right across the street from the Wrigley Building. It's a beautiful night outside. Spent the last hour talking about the George Lucas Museum of Narrative Art, which we thought we were going to have here on the lakefront for a while, and George Lucas has decided to take his billion-dollar museum elsewhere. The biggest story going on around the world right now is all about Britain and the voters of Britain deciding to exit, the voters of the UK deciding to exit the European Union. And the backlash from that has been pretty interesting from the markets around the world that plunged, and concerns now, not only about what's going to happen in Britain, what's going to happen to the European Union and how that's going to play throughout the world. Joining us on the phone right now is Professor Christopher Bovis. He's a lead advisor to the United Kingdom Cabinet Office on Growth Strategy and special advisor to the UN on public-private partnerships. Hello, Professor Bovis. Thank you so much for being on the phone with us.
Hey, good evening. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Is it shock over there right now? We keep hearing that people are kind of shocked that it happened this way. I know that the polling was very close. It looked like things were leaning more towards a vote for remaining in the European Union. Were you surprised by the results?
Yes. Everybody was surprised. It was a seismic reaction for the markets, for completely revamping what we used to know for the last four decades as a European Union with the United Kingdom inside. Nobody expected that. The markets couldn't even predict it, that the electorate was so disenfranchised and voted overwhelmingly to leave the European Union.
Well, was it overwhelmingly? I thought it was 52%.
In many states, in many regions within the United Kingdom, you will see up to 75% in the Middle England moving towards the exit. Scotland, for example, moved overwhelmingly 60% to remain in the European Union. So you realize even the problem is not UK versus the European Union, but mainly what is the UK strategy for the years to come? Is Scotland part of the UK, or is Northern Ireland coming back again with the Republic of Ireland to reunite. These are the completely different issues that the referendum couldn't predict.
So I don't understand the European Union completely. There was a great thing being shared around on social media today of a cartoon that tried to explain exactly, you know, this is everybody comes together, we make it easier to work together because we have one single set of rules for all these countries, and that makes it easy to work in another country, to visit, to produce goods that can be sold in other countries, things like that. What is the biggest reason that Britain would vote, and what drove people to vote to exit? Is it controlling your borders more? Is it the terrorism scares around the world and people moving from country to country too easily?
It's mainly immigration. Exactly the same debate you have in the United States of America, exactly the same debate we have across the world now, is the movement or the irregular movement of migration. And that created serious uncertainty in the electorate, and they realize that we need to protest, we need to create something to the establishment, to the government, to move away from what we used to know as a free trade area. The European Union is great. In theory, it's fantastic. It's free trade, tax-free zone, free movement of people, but it has many problems. It has serious issues that require urgent attention. Like any other free trade zone, like what you have in United States with Canada, the NAFTA agreement, like the World Trade Organization, on paper, they're fantastic. In reality, they leave a lot to be desired.
Yeah, somebody compared the way the European Union works together to the way we have separate states here in the United States. Is that a fair kind of comparison?
Yes, yes, it's quite fair comparison, because the underlying principle is free trade. The underlying principle is mobility of production factors, capital, innovation, research, and also growth. We need growth like the earth needs rain. It's absolutely paramount that we need to see economic growth across the Atlantic, both parts of Europe, United Kingdom, United States, and Canada, more than anything else. That would sustain probably, you know, the best anxieties out of the electorate.
So I would say that I guess the big difference would be here in America, whatever state we're from, we still consider ourselves foremost Americans. Now, depending on what state you're from, Texans might say, no, we're Texans and we're Americans second. Some places in America, you know, we're very territorial. But overall, if I moved from Illinois here where I live to California to New York, it's not a big deal. But I imagine that when and I imagine between Britain and France and Spain, in certain areas, it's not a big deal. But when it's, you know, refugees from poorer countries or immigrants from very poor countries coming and taking jobs, I also imagine that there's concern about growing Muslim populations in certain countries. Is that part of the I guess maybe the emotional vote here? Were people getting scared of Muslim people moving to Britain in too heavy of numbers?
To a large extent, yes. To a large extent, the politicians, the political system failed to ease the pressure, failed to ease the problems of integrating this mobility of labor, this mobility of people between countries. You mentioned that quite often in the United States of America, which is a greatly advanced federal system, the American culture, the American example, supersedes, for example, the Texas or the Massachusetts or even the New York brand. But in the European Union, you still have the underlying culture of, for example, the Britain or the England or the Scots or the French or even the Italian. So you have a dual brand image to look after in order to unify and integrate the system.
Can the countries within the European Union not control their – I mean, I know it's a set of guidelines that everybody lives by, but is there leeway for each country? If Britain wanted to slow its population growth by slowing down its borders, was there no ability for them to do that without leaving the union?
Yes, of course, there is ability. Of course, you know, it's failing the negotiations. Britain, for example, is not part of the Schengen Agreement, which means that you can travel within Europe without demonstrating your passport or showing your ID. Britain has borders, full control of its borders. So you can even create a system with a quota system, like perhaps you have in Australia or you have in other parts of the world, in order to interfere with migration there. It's up to the clever negotiations, the intelligence system that you have in order to control migrations. You have that debate now with the current elections in the United States about how you can control right. north and south of your borders migration.
Okay, so if you could have controlled that more, if they could have negotiated within the European Union to get more control over that, then what is the big benefit for people who did vote and wanted you to exit the European Union? What is a benefit that could be seen from this?
Nobody knows about that. This is the biggest fundamental question that we have now. They wake up now and they say, oh, what we have done now. We voted to leave 52%. Let's leave the European Union. But there's no plan B. There's no plan. How are you going to deal? And you reciprocate the trade deals with other parts of the European Union or the United States or in Canada. And you know something, bilateral agreements between the UK and other parts of the world are completely native. They're very, very, very small mind. They don't have even the flexibility that you have in a proper international trade deals to perform and grow trade between those.
All right, so you got a lot of work ahead of you for the next year because this doesn't take effect for a while. David Cameron has said he's going to resign and the next leader can lead this. And it doesn't have to happen, though, right? I mean, I believe that David Cameron said the will of the people needs to be followed. So we'll do this. The next leader will lead them there. But I believe it's Article 50 has to be invoked. So could there be a scenario where Britain does not, in fact, despite this vote, actually exit the European Union?
There is a high probability, and I congratulate you for forecasting that. There's a high probability that there will be some deal made in order to prolong as long as possible Article 50, which is the official divorce procedures between the United Kingdom and the European Union, and try to sort out a deal and say what would appease, for example, the people to at least remain within the common market, respect the free movement principles, but have a say, have a degree of control for migration or perhaps the border. That is one very possible scenario that perhaps we can get some momentum there. But you need to also look at the other side of the continent, you know, what's happening in Germany or in France. They have serious problems themselves, and they see Britain or the United Kingdom as competitor, as they see the United States as a competitor. And they need to, as soon as possible, get clarity and some degree of normality back into their markets.
Well, and I would,
there is a pressure.
I would think, Professor Bovis, that there's going to be a pressure on Britain here and on the UK. First of all, Scotland, as you said, voted to remain overwhelmingly. And so that could lead to another independence vote for Scotland, I would imagine, at some point if they're upset about this. But also the remaining members of the European Union who want the union to stay strong now will have an active interest in Britain not doing well. Because if things turn out well, the pound comes back, the markets rise, and it looks, if a year from now things look really strong for Britain for having done this, that's going to cause, I would imagine, or could cause, the rest of the European Union to dissolve, because other countries will say, wait a minute, why are we sticking with this if that's working out well for them? So it's going to be in their active interest for this not to work out well for you.
That is the Trojan horse. Exactly. Again, congratulations for forecasting that scenario. That is the Trojan horse behind the whole arena, behind the arrangement, because you have issues, serious centrifugal issues in Spain. Catalonia wants to declare independence. Half of the European Union have seen tremendous rise in the sort of right-wing or extreme parties. They want to dissolve. They don't want to make an opposition. They want to create a dissolving, grounding structure in Europe and its politics. And we want to avoid the European elite, politicians, they want to avoid that. Even your president, President Obama, came to the UK and said, stick with the European Union, get all the allies into one basket, because we have many other enemies, many other competitors that will try to hurt us, including for energy or any international deals. For example, I'm referring to Russia or other parts of competition in China or overseas.
If you had a crystal ball, where would you say Britain is a year from now? Will you be exiting the European Union? And if so, what do you think that's going to mean for Britain?
I put a hedge bet here. If I was a bet man, I would put a hedge bet and says they're going to prolong as long as possible the negotiations in order to try to make a deal with the European Union to respect the common market, the free movement principles, and leave some degree of maneuver for immigration and specifically issues that relate to the core of the British Brexit campaign. On a hard note, a lot of people will say, okay, we're going to finish with that and completely cut all the links. And that will be the tremendous shock to the system. And you will see that quite often. As of today, Moody's downgraded the outlook of the United Kingdom to negative. And that will not create good vibes in the government.
I wouldn't think so. Well, Prime Minister Cameron announced he's resigning. When will there be an election to replace him? And how much does whether or not you fully exit the union depend on who gets elected? Because if it's somebody who thinks this was the greatest thing, that now this is a great day, you know, I forget who it was I read declared this is our Independence Day. If that dude ends up running the country and he's all gung-ho about it, then you probably would fully exit, wouldn't you?
That is a high probability there. But you need also to understand that the Britain, United Kingdom, doesn't have the army of technocrats to negotiate the deals. The last 40 years, they emigrated all these specific technocratic brains that do the trade deals that what you have in the States on your speed dial. We don't have them here. They left. They left completely for Brussels. They went to the United States or Canada or abroad. So we start from scratch. If they have to team up with a number of technocrats to negotiate free trade of, let's say, motor vehicles between United States and United Kingdom, we start from scratch one. And you talk about multi-annual negotiations. It will take years before even you start selling product one.
Well, it's going to be an interesting year ahead. Professor Christopher Bovis, thank you so much for being on the phone. I hope we can keep your number and chat again about this down the road.
Thank you very much. Godspeed. All the best.
You too. Have a great weekend. Professor Christopher Bovis, he's the lead advisor to the UK Cabinet on growth strategy. And I imagine that made his job a lot tougher in the coming weeks and months to come. It's the Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. Well, there's still months left to go here before we finally get to the polls and decide who is going to be the next president of the United States. But every day we hear more and more and more from both sides of the aisle. So what do we filter out? What do we take home? What do we start thinking about? And what is purely just propaganda that you should set aside? Let's find out from an expert. Leslie Shore is the owner of Listen to Succeed. It's a consultancy that focuses on listening analytics. Her book is Listen to Succeed, How to Identify and Overcome Barriers to Effective Listening. Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? I'm good.
Good. I'm good, too. But I'm wondering how this ties into our politics. Is it the way we listen to what is being said and then disseminate what we should keep and what we should throw away?
Well, it is indeed a question of how you're listening and what barriers you might be having. And in what we're talking about in terms of politics right now is that it's the emotions that are being played with, toyed with, pinged, hooked, you name it. What's happening out there now has a lot of emotional base to it.
Now, in general, I think I would say that that's coming more from one side than the other. But in reality, both sides do this. All sides do it in political contests, right? They prey on your emotion. Go ahead.
Yeah, all sides do it. Both sides and up the middle of the aisle, and indeed we just saw how dangerous it can be with what happened in terms of Britain leaving
the European Union.
The European Union. And they had a gentleman over there that was a separatist who used the exact same tactics in terms of emotionality and generalities and those types of things to get people to react out of fear and emotion, which are only two parts of our brain, but they're the ones that propaganda actually goes towards.
That's interesting. So, you know, it's funny, after that happened earlier today, I'm looking online, and I see a headline that says
thing it said, people in the UK are Googling what is the EU at an alarming rate, as if many people voted one way based on emotion or whatever. Now they're like, wait, why is this such a big deal? What did we do? And maybe are going to come to realize whether or not this was a mistake.
And to that point, perfectly to that point, we have to have an electorate that is educated. And the way to educate the electorate is actually to appeal to their critical thinking part of their brain and not the other two. And the issue here is that over there and over here, we are seeing people really playing to the economic disaffected and the people that are quote-unquote angry. And we're cruising for a bruise and going to the same result if we do not put on our thinking caps and filter out what's propaganda and what is not.
Well, and so for a politician, though, it makes perfect sense to prey on fear and emotion because it kind of works, doesn't it? I mean, it's up to us to figure to step back and say, well, let's use our critical thinking and not our fear and emotion, right?
I would agree with you. I have to say that I think there are a few ex-presidents that are turning over right now because they actually got into power by actually educating the public as to what the situation was. But, you know, politicians are smart. That's how they get up to that level of office. And I think for us, what we have to do is understand what the warning signs are of what that propaganda is being foisted on us. Physically, Matt, our bodies actually react to something that we're going in our heads. Is that really true? And if you say that to yourself, Matt, your nose will crinkle, your eyes will do something weird, and it's your body saying something's not right here. So there's actually a physiology to hearing something that you do not actually believe is true.
All right, well, I think one of the really tough things is we get further and further into our political process in regards to this election. We have two very divergent sides. And people fervently believe in their candidate and amazingly have an amount of vitriol towards the other candidate. And this is happening on both sides of the aisle with this particular election. I think these are probably two of the most disliked candidates in history. I don't know if they're also two of the most liked candidates. I don't think that they are. But they're certainly two of the most disliked candidates if you're not for them. And I wonder when we get to a point right now, it seems like everything you see on social media and people talking, not journalists, but people talking to each other and what they spread and post, they're so, this is the right person, this is the right thing. And I wonder at what point our brain sort of shuts off to being willing to listen to another side or being willing to think about what the other side thinks or why so many people don't like your own candidate, different things like that. It feels like we get set in, that's the person, I don't care what you say, this is who I'm going with, no matter what.
And Matt, I agree with you. There's a element of groupthink to it. There's an element of not being able to listen without the ego in place, listen cleanly so that what message is coming in actually has an opportunity to reach your brain for you to respond to. But what we're dealing with, and this is what is so difficult, that a poll just came out saying that half of the Republicans regard Democrats as more immoral, lazy, and dishonest, but 7 in 10 Democrats review Republicans as more close-minded. And there's that close-mindedness. It takes a lot of courage to keep your mind open to something opposite that you at that moment believe. But that's where growth actually comes from.
So if you're a politician, maybe you don't care that anybody's going to do that. You just want to prey on the people that are going to vote for you or listen to what you have to say, rally around the people that are more likely to think in your frame of mind.
Yes.
What do we do as Americans? We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Leslie Shore. Listen to Succeed is the book, listentosucceed.com. So what do we do to encourage ourselves and America as a whole to be more open-minded so we're not just 50% think one way, 50% think the other way, and there's no middle ground? We don't have an America where the politicians work together anymore, and it seems like our citizenry is the same way. We think one side and we don't care about the other. We disagree with it wholeheartedly. How do we step back and get ourselves to be a little more open-minded? Can it be done? We'll ask Leslie that next. Matt Bubala with you on Radio 720 WGN. We're speaking with Leslie Shore. Her book is Listen to Succeed, listentosucceed.com. You can find her on facebook.com/listentosucceed. Matt Bubala here with you on Radio 720 WGN. Leslie, we were talking before the break about how divided we are and how set in our ways we seem to be. And you said it's a courageous person who can step back and see the other side. So how do we personally find ways to do that? How do we encourage America as a whole to get back to a place where discussion and thought are something we're willing to step back and encourage and think about instead of getting so upset with one side or the other all the time?
Well, I would say, Matt, that the first thing is that we have to be willing to actually talk with people that are not of our normal group. When you get together with a whole bunch of people that think like you, what happens is that everything that the group thinks about is validated by the group, and therefore we become more and more and more closed. So one of the things that as a citizen to do is actually to get out amongst people that are not of our mindset, to listen to radio, to watch television, pundits that are not the people that we normally do, and actually begin to open our minds to what might be actually some truth on the other side. Again, that takes courage, and that is really a tough thing. But the second thing is, let's take a look when we go back to what happened in Britain this morning. The pound has already taken a beating, and we're looking at an economic situation there that could have really dire consequences for the citizenry of England. And I think we need to take a look at what are the consequences of us not being educated in these things that are so important. We can't sit with glittering generalities. It's going to be great. It's going to be perfect. It's going to get fixed. We actually have to see how is this going to happen. And we have to have that information before we vote.
When it comes to Americans and how we think and how we're divided, there's an old saying that if you're not a Democrat when you're young, you have no heart or no soul. And if you're not a Republican when you're older, you have no money.
Right.
So in generalities, people do tend to sort of change their thinking over the years. Is that because they listen, because they change? Why in some ways are people willing to change and in other ways people are not?
You know, I think, first of all, that quote is absolutely dead on the money. And I think that one of the most important things as we grow and age is that we continue to educate ourselves. My grandmother, in her wisdom, said about education, if you're not expanding, you're contracting. And till the day she passed, she was having conversations with her grandchildren that told us she was more up to date on everything than we were. And that's the type of thing that we have to do in order to guard against us getting more narrowly laser-like focused in just one place.
But don't you think that's really tough? I mean, that's great. And of course, that all makes sense. We should keep expanding. But are we setting ourselves up to not do that anymore? I know that even somebody like me who's a talk show host who has to stay on top of things, who should be, I tend to read news on my phone and see headlines and then decide whether or not to go any further. When it used to be growing up that the Chicago Tribune came to our front door every day and we'd leaf through it and take some time, you'd read a story that you wouldn't otherwise read, that you're not going to read when Google Analytics is deciding what news you're most interested in or Facebook algorithm is deciding what you would be interested in seeing. We're closing ourselves off from so much these days. I know so much more is available to us than ever before, but are we willing to look at it? Do we have the time because we've jam-packed our lives with so much stuff? I worry that we're headed to this abyss of not caring to expand as we get older.
And I think you are right to put the finger on technology right now. I remember picking up in my youth a Boston Globe. First place I'd go to after the comics would be the editorial page. And it was so intriguing to read the editorial and then the op-ed piece. And that was something that was part of my education. But now that everyone is consuming news via the electronics, that they can, to your point, narrow down to, I'm just going to get my news from here. I'm not exactly sure, and I am somewhat fearful of how the American citizenry is really going to get themselves educated, or whether it will take something large like what's happening in Britain or something else that will actually snap us back to, hey, how the heck did that happen and how come I didn't know?
Well, in less than 5 months, there might be something that happens just like that. Leslie, we'll see. We're going to see whether that's what happens when we go to the polls in November, in early November, and see what happens there. And the other side might feel the same way if it's somebody else. Like, I mean, either side, people might be upset about or will be upset. It's going to be a very interesting time in America. Certainly an interesting time internationally, as Leslie was saying, Britain exiting the EU and what that means and what that will mean worldwide and how we step back and listen. The book is called Listen to Succeed, How to Identify and Overcome Barriers to Effective Listening. Facebook.com/listen to succeed. Hopefully we don't have to put that on the website because everybody heard that and listened really well, but we'll make sure that we podcast this up at WGNradio.com as well. Leslie Shore, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us.
It was my pleasure, Matt.
You're listening to the Matt Bubala Show on Radio 720 WGN. Matt Bubala Show, Radio 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Bright start to your day. Sun's already starting to come out. It's getting a little brighter outside already. By the time we're heading home at 5, it's going to be out and bright. It's crazy. But it's already starting to get dark, a little bit darker every day. By what, like a minute, Laura, every day it gets darker?
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. But your perky music woke me up.
It's
Thank
funny.
You for the perky
You're very
music.
Welcome. Yeah, you got a half hour to go. Well, what time are you on?
No,
until?
I'm on until 5:30, I think.
Oh, that's not too bad.
I won't know until somebody
that's
else comes
not too
in
bad.
And they go.
Yeah, hopefully
yeah, but
somebody
then
else
I have to go to
up.
Another job. So, and I'm going to stay in my deck. It's a busy day.
So you're going from here directly to another job?
Actually, I'm
and then
going
home
here
to stay, in deck?
To stay in my deck, and then I'm going to go to another job at 10 a.m. because I just feel like it's a waste of time to try to sleep.
You're going to go home at 5:30 in the morning and start staining your deck and then head to another job?
Uh-huh. That's right. That's the plan. We'll see how that goes. And then I got to be back here, I think, at midnight. But I'm not positive. I know I'm going to be back here tonight. That I know.
I'm just going to say, Laura, I say a good hour and a half nap.
Well, then sleep is get, for losers. I'll sleep when I'm dead.
You might be dead if you don't get some sleep.
I'll be okay.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll be real loopy tomorrow right. night, though.
Yes, you will.
Are you working overnight tomorrow
I am not. I only do the one night. I'm not crazy enough to do two.
Mm-hmm.
You'll have Mr. Plyer here to keep you entertained throughout the evening.
Or maybe I'll keep him entertained.
Well, you might if you're going on no sleep, that's for sure.
I'll be loopy
All
for
right,
sure.
Well, stay safe. All right. Make sure you're careful as you're staining.
Okay.
All right. So there's a gentleman named Adam Sultan. And he is an adventure guy. He does crazy stuff all the time. And his latest adventures, he's going to go around the world in 80 ways. He's going to work 80 different jobs. Mostly he's going to be working voluntarily. And he's going to learn different cultures and do things like that. And he is going to, I believe, ride a bike around the world. Let's hear more about it. He joins us on the phone right now. Good morning, Adam. How are you?
Hello. Good to speak to you.
It's good to speak to you. Where are we speaking to you at? Where are you located?
I'm from London, and I'm actually still in London. I had a launch event here last Saturday for the Ride the World project, and I'm actually going to be leaving Well, something came up, and as you were just talking about my 80 ways around the world, one of my friends has just bought a double-decker bus, and he needs a hand gutting it out to make it into a work, a co-work living space. So I'm going to be lending a hand on the bus project next week. So that's delayed my actual departure from London.
Hold on a minute. Hold on, Adam.
Kicking off one of my 80 ways around the world.
Hold on. So you're doing this whole trip, 80 ways around the world. It's going to take you 5 years. You're delaying it because a buddy bought a bus and he needs help fixing it up.
Correct.
Well, I don't know whether to think you're the most helpful guy in the world or just crazy. How are you delaying this trip that's a five-year trip because this dude bought a bus?
Well, it's not every day your mate buys a bus, right?
I hope not, I guess. But he's converting this double-decker bus into a home and office?
Yes, and not just for himself. There's a community in London called the Yes Tribe, and we're quite adventurous, and we like to, you know, work together on different projects, help each other out. And normally we go on a weekly camp out, whereas now we've got the flexibility to just hang out on a bus if we want to and work on our projects.
Well, that sounds cool. You won't get to use the bus for about 5 years, though, if things go according to plan, right?
Yeah, this is it. He bought the bus maybe 6 weeks ago, and I was like, no way, you bought the bus just as I'm leaving. But I've managed to schedule in a day next week to go and lend a hand.
All right, so tell me a little bit about this trip you're going to do. You've done other big things for charity before that involve adventure and travel, but now you're planning on riding a bike around the world. Is that right?
That is right. I had a friend a couple years ago. She rode her bike around every state in U.S. state.
Okay.
And she came back with so much enthusiasm for her adventure. And I was leaning towards an adventure. I just wasn't quite sure what it was going to be. And then I thought, you know what? Why don't you just ride a bike around the world? And honestly, it made sense. It sounds crazy, but it made sense in my mind to cycle around the world.
Well, it is crazy, but it does sound really cool, like the ultimate adventure. Now, normally when people do something like they're going to row a boat from Japan to the U.S. or they're going to ride the bike in all 50 states, there's some way that they've raised money to, or they're raising money to make them able to do it. And usually these are like maybe the craziest ones or a 6 month adventure. If this is for 5 years, how are you supporting yourself during that time?
So I've known for nearly 2 years, this is what I want to do. And I was actually, I've just been listening in to your latest chat, and I used to work night shifts as well.
Excellent.
And yeah, so the past couple of years, I've just been saving up each month, putting a little bit aside. And I'm going to be on a really tight budget. So most of the time I'm going to be wild camping. There's networks, couch surfing, warm showers where local hosts will pick you up. And it's not just, you know, about getting a free night. It's about meeting the people as well, where for me, that's one of the most important parts of travel is meeting the locals. They'll tell you all the little secrets quite often, especially on a bike. They'll tell you nice routes to go along. And yeah, the majority of my money is just literally going to be spent on food. I don't need too much else.
Yeah. And you'll work along the way, but mostly doing voluntary jobs?
Right. So 3 summers ago, I was out in Madagascar with a charity, Seed Madagascar.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a huge impact on me in terms of just seeing the effect of deforestation. I was on a conservation program with them, and I felt like it really just hit home the effect, but also that, you know, if you work together with the local communities in these countries, you can have a positive influence on the future of the world.
Are you hoping
I'm going to be fundraising for them.
Yeah. You're going to raise money for a bunch of different charities, or is it all going to one?
So there's 5 charities. Each one of them, I have a personal connection, I feel. And yeah, it's just about, you know, some are UK-based but have online services. A cancer support charity, for example. Mm-hmm. I caught up with them recently, and they had their most successful year internationally on their website last year. And then there's charities where you'll be based in Southern African countries, getting bikes out to less advantaged communities where a bike's a difference between work, education, healthcare, the essentials of life, really.
And how are you asking people to donate? Is it like by mile that you ride on the trip or just make a donation to support the cause?
Yeah, I mean, just at the moment, it's just a donation on virginmoneygiving.com, ride the world. And that, you know, I don't want to put pressure on, you know, myself or a donor to say, you know, a mile or a dollar.
Right.
We'll just see how it goes.
I understand. So if people want to donate or find out more about donating, virginmoneygiving.com/ride the world.
And the website where everything is just adamtsultan.com.
Adam T. Sultan, SULTAN.com to find out more. I have to ask you an odd question because we just spoke with a professor from the UK an hour ago about Brexit. Is that oddly going to affect you as you try to go from country to country?
Well, that's another reason I held back my departure day. I felt it was important to vote. And I mean, the effects, I don't think we're still going to be in for 2 years, I believe. So in the short term, you know, it's definitely, in my opinion, a negative thing. But I don't think it's going to affect me in the short term while I'm traveling through Europe. But, you know, who knows the long-term effects.
Might have trouble getting back home in the end.
Maybe I won't go back.
Well, let me ask, so what is the most exciting part of this trip that you have planned? What's a crazy thing or ultimate adventure that you'll have as part of this 5 years that you're really looking forward to?
So with France on my doorstep, I've often overlooked it when I've been traveling. And I've got a friend who's half French, and we went to her parents for New Year's 6 months ago, and just driving through France, I was in awe of just how beautiful France is. So I'm going to take on the 2014 Tour de France, simply because it actually started in England and had a stage through London. So it's the only one I've actually been to see. And I just thought, you know what, I was thinking, oh, which way should I go, which way? Why not just follow the most iconic cycling race in the world?
Yeah. I didn't realize that the Tour de France map isn't the same every year. It actually changes every year?
Yeah, so they normally launch it in a different country and, you know, for one, two, or three stages. Then it gets back into France, and then it will always finish in Paris, but the route changes each year and, you know, can be anywhere in France.
Did I see also that you're going to ride your bike up the Himalayas or something crazy like that?
Oh, yeah. So I love the mountains, but the only like huge range that I've explored so far were the Canadian Rockies. And I just feel like, why not? You know, what a way to experience mountain life by traveling from one end to another. So who knows, you know, I've got a friend who has traveled through the Andes. So I'll certainly be calling on them for tips.
Yeah.
But it can be done.
And do you know somebody in each place you're planning on going? Will you have something set up? You're not just showing up in a town in some foreign country going, hey, I'm a dude riding a bike around the world. Can I hang out here for a while?
Quite often that might well be the case. I've actually, through contacts and everything, they generally say that the less people have, the more willing they are to give you something. I had a dude who just kayaked down the Amazon, and he literally said, we just rocked up in this tiny little shanty town, and the parents moved all the kids out of the bedrooms so this dude could just have a bed. So, you know, the world's a good place most of the time.
And you'll just count on kindness a lot.
Right, the kindness of strangers.
Do you think you really will be doing this for the next 5 years?
Sometimes I think about it and I think, oh, you know what? Maybe after 2 years, I'll just start pedaling fast every day. And then sometimes I think, and it could, you know, be a 10-year project, might be a lifelong project. I just, you know, I've already, because my mates bought a bus, I've like, okay, I need to hang around for another week just to lend a hand on the bus. So now I'm thinking that could happen quite often.
That is very interesting. Well, it's going to be a great adventure. We're going to keep your number, and we'd love to check in. Will you have, like, a satellite phone or something? Will you be able to stay in touch with the world?
Yeah, just I'd love to give you a call back at some point.
Yeah.
Who knows? Like, hopefully, I'll be in Chicago one day.
Yeah, that's right. Do you know where you'll be in the U.S. when you're getting to the U.S., or is it not exactly planned out yet?
So I've got a rough idea to cycle from the tip of South America to Alaska along the West Coast, and then wind my way back down through Canada and the sort of Central America, or Central of the United States, in possibly finishing in New York. I just don't know yet.
Yeah, excellent. Well, we'll stay in touch. Hold on. Let me have you talk to Shantae a little bit more so she can make sure she has all of your information. His name is Adam Sultan. You can find him at adamtsultan.com, S-U-L-T-A-N, adamtsultan.com. And if you want to donate, virginmoneygiving.com/ride the world. Whoopsie, had my microphone on there. Sorry about that. Matt Bubala with you for a couple more minutes here on 720 WGN. Orion's coming up with the morning show in a couple of minutes. Mike Steven will be by with Outside the Loop. Mike Steven will be by with Outside the Loop Radio later on this morning. Then our sweet old Lou Manfredini comes in and the girlfriends. Lots of good stuff. John Williams, good Saturday to stay with us here at WGN Radio. So my son Jack plays on a travel baseball team. All of my boys do. And Jack's a 14. He actually just turned 15 this week, but he's on a 14 and under travel baseball team. And they have a tournament this weekend in Battle Creek, Michigan. And they were supposed to play their first game on Friday night. And we had a game on Thursday night. And afterwards, we're out, family's out at dinner. And we get a text from the coach saying the games at the tournament on Friday night have been canceled. And you all need to, I'm sending an email with the information as to why. And as a group, we need to decide whether or not we want to attend this tournament after all. So we see that. We're like, well, that's interesting. Why would we? I understand they cancel games because of an event or something going on, but why would that make us decide whether or not we should go to this tournament at all? So we get the email, and the tournament's in Battle Creek, Michigan this weekend. And there's a minor league baseball team. It's actually a team full of college kids. It's a summer team. It's part of the Northwoods League. It's made up of college players who play summer ball. And so it's a minor league team called the Battle Creek Bombers. And, you know, when there's minor league teams, they have all kinds of crazy special promotions because you got to bring people out to the park. You got to make it fun. You got to make it crazy. You got to make it this. You got to make it that. So they had a couple of promotions. It was fireworks night. It was also Boy Scout night. And it was, now, this minor league team, the reason this plays into the term is the minor league team is, their stadium is part of a complex of fields, and everybody shares a big parking lot. So if we would have played our game on Friday night, we would have been parking in the same parking lot that the fans that are going to this game would have been going to, because the fields are all interconnected by this big parking lot. And so fireworks night for the Battle Creek Bombers, Boy Scout night for the Battle Creek Bombers. Oh, and Second Amendment education night.
Oh.
And so the fans were allowed to bring their guns to the game.
Oh, wow.
So the people running the tournament, I think, wisely thought, okay, I'm sure they're all responsible gun owners and everything's cool, but... And the team said, we will not serve alcohol to anybody who brings a firearm with.
But, how do you know?
Well, that's kind of the tough part. And everybody's out in the parking lot, maybe tailgating a little bit before.
And that's where your kids are.
And that's where all these young families are. And, you know, responsible gun owners are good people. And I searched. There were no news reports about it. But... the Bombers, I'm reading a news report from beforehand where Bombers general manager Tony Iovino tells the Battle Creek Inquirer that the event is a way to promote gun safety and to showcase Freedom Firearms, the area business that is sponsoring the event. So it sounds like a gun shop or a shooting range that sponsored it. Those with guns will get a wristband and won't be allowed to purchase alcohol. So if you come in with a gun, you get a wristband, which you could take off, I would imagine, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
But so out of an abundance of caution, they said, we're going to cancel the Friday night games. So we're not going to share a parking lot with a bunch of people that are, you know, bringing guns. So I thought that was smart of them, I think. Better safe than sorry. Yeah. You never know if something's going to go wrong.
You know, when my kids were little, when they had a play date, I actually asked the people before we crossed that doorstep, I said, do you have any firearms in your house?
Yeah.
Because it means that much to me to not have my child in a home with a firearm.
You hear so many times when there is an accident like that where there is a gun in the house and, you know,
children are just playing. I mean, they don't know. you know. So I just would prefer, everybody has a different opinion about it. But for me, yeah. I would prefer not to have my kids in a house where there is a firearm. And yeah. so,
I understand
you
that.
You know, I totally would get
because
it
you're not
League.
There. You're not there and you don't know what kind of safety precautions they've taken.
That's true.
And
even if
like
I
that.
Am there, I don't, honestly, I don't want to be in a house with a firearm either. Yeah. So, you know.
So I thought that was interesting. I'd never heard of a tournament games getting canceled for that reason.
But thought, that's a good well, reason. I was really curious.
You know, it's just, you know, nothing happened apparently. It was safe, you know.
Sure.
But it's funny that the promotions that a minor league team will do.
Wow.
Bring your gun to the game night. Sponsored by Freedom Firearms. They were
they
giving away. They did
something?
Say the Bombers will provide free trigger locks to fans.
No way, really?
Yes. So that's a good idea.
I don't
well,
even
if
know
saying,
what a trigger lock is. Do you know what that is?
It is a safety device that locks and that's very tough for kids, I believe, to get undone. You know that it's sort of like a low jack for your trigger.
For
I think.
Yeah.
You know, you it's something you connect to the gun that prevents the trigger from being fired.
So I assume it's a one size fit all, and it works on all guns.
I don't know. I can't imagine it is. I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. But I also know that it's the type of thing that. You know, it's a very tough thing, I think, for gun owners because you need to be extremely safe, especially if you have small kids in the house, where you keep the gun, that it's locked up and all these things. But on the other hand, if I'm keeping a gun in the house, the reason is I'm worried that I might need to use it at some point. So the more difficult you make it to get to it, the more difficult it's going to be for you to use it to protect yourself or your family in a dire situation. So it's a real, you know, that's a real tough one, I think, for gun owners. But
unless you just keep them for sport.
Yes, absolutely. In which case, you know, hopefully you got a big,
in which case you
big
lock
vault
them
that you lock
and,
it up and,
right,
and make
take
sure
you
that
a long time to get them.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.